Before we get to the show, let me remind you that we are now in the middle of our Kickstarter campaign for Inside the Fantastique, a brand new weekly video interview show for lovers of science fiction, fantasy, and horror film that we want to bring you starting in 2014, courtesy of Cinefantastique Online. But we need your help to do it. So, go to kickstarter.com and do a search on Cinefantastique, or go to the post for this show on mightymoviepodcast.com, and we'll have the link there, and those will get you to the campaign page. You can watch the pilot there, see John Sayles and Yolanda Ross giving their endorsement. Also, take your pick of some groovy rewards, including glow-in-the-dark t-shirts, t-shirts with original art by famed cartoonist Bill Plimpton, and you'll be helping us big time as well. Go behind the scenes, help us take you inside the Fantastique, and thank you. And as for the film we're discussing today, well, you know, it's your typical buddy-buddy mystery thriller. One's a probation officer, one's a recovering junkie, one's a blind ex-cop. Okay, not so typical. There's one extra ones in there, at least. I think I detect the hand of John Sayles here. We're going to be talking with him and his co-star, Yolanda Ross, about their new film, Go For Sisters, on this episode of Mighty Movie Podcast.
Gamble, and I'm a drug addict.
Who's your friend?
I'm Bernice Stokes. I'm not an alcoholic or a drug addict or anything. I'm a parole officer.
I had her once. She's a real ball buster.
Your son, he's a suspect.
In the murder?
I'll do what I can. But some of the people I gotta talk to, that's a violation of my parole.
Not if you inform your parole officer and get approval. I'm your parole officer.
Her son's gotten into some mess.
Last I heard, that boy went down to the border.
You checked the Suarez? These people need to talk to you.
This looks like trouble.
I want him back. And if there's any way, I don't want him to go to jail.
$2,000 up front, then. Cash.
We used to call him the Terminator.
He's doing some side business. He can get snatched by the snakeheads in TJ. They sent me his ear, man.
What's next?
We go to TJ. This is in Mexico. This is like a theme park for bad behavior. I got a good idea where to start.
You got connections with the local police?
The police don't run this town.
What is it you want to buy?
A young black man.
You're the wrong century, my friend.
Back off!
Hey, don't you push me, Morenita!
Hey, move away from her!
Ex-Detective Suarez.
They're smugglers. They have their own way of doing things. Your son might be dead already.
You can't protect him forever, Bernice.
You can try.
I don't remember why we fell out.
You stole my boyfriend.
You come after me.
Hey, welcome to MMP. I'm Dan Persons. And once again, John Sayles mixes real-world concerns with the pop genre for Go For Sisters, a mystery thriller centered around the dark world of illegal immigration. The plot has probation officer Bernice, played by Lisa Gay Hamilton, in search of her missing son, who may have gotten into some bad trouble and fled across the Mexican border. She recruits an old friend to do that, Fontaine, played by Yolanda Ross, who's now a recovering addict and, ironically, put in Bernice's charge during her probation. And together, they also bring in a disgraced former policeman with impaired vision, played by Edward James Olmos, to help them. And off they go across the border for a fun adventure, if by fun you mean getting shot at, dealing with human traffickers and drug dealers. Just your typical holiday. It's a cool twist on the crime thriller, got that John Sayles border town feel to it, and that's good. So, I was lucky enough to sit down with John Sayles and Yolanda Ross for this interview. Here it is now. This caught my attention. Who knew there was a Chinatown in Mexico?
I knew it, actually. Mexicali, which is just across the border from Calexico, Mexicali, they say down there, in the 20s and 30s actually had more Chinese people than Mexican people. And it became that way because Harry Chandler, who owned the LA Times, was the son-in-law of General Lotus, who started it, had a ranch down there. And he was too cheap to even pay Mexican wages, the braceros. And so he brought Chinese people in, some of whom had been already working in the railroads and things like that, and some just came with families. And so for a long time, that was a very Chinese city. And it still has, you know, lots of Chinese restaurants and names and stuff like that. And you can see a lot of the people still look very Chinese, some of them, you know, part Mexican and some of them kind of almost full Chinese. And during the La Ley Seca, the prohibition time, there was a good amount of smuggling through tunnels and over land that went on there. And there's still, every once in a while, both in Tijuana and in Mexicali, they find a tunnel. This is something that, you know, doing research for other things, I just stumbled on. And I had been aware of this fact that after the economic downturn here, there was just less work for, you know, mostly, you know, Mexican people from Central America coming up to, you know, work in people's yards and build, you know, stone walls and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of them started going home. It wasn't enough work. You know, they don't want to be United States citizens necessarily. They just want to make a living. But the traffic in Chinese kept going. And that it was a totally different circuit, and that there was this phenomenon of a guarantee, which is you pay a lot more, but we guarantee we get you there, or then you go back in line and we'll try again if you don't get there. And we give you papers that will probably pass.
Yolanda, you work with John Sayles. You get to travel. So, did you know about Chinatown?
No, of course not. I mean, I'd never even been to Mexico before, let alone know about Chinatown. I didn't. So, I mean, I do enjoy, you know, when you take on a part, learning something. So I definitely learned there.
What's it like working on a location? What was it like working on a location for this particular film? Because the shooting time frame was tight.
Yeah, shooting was tight. There's a lot of locations. I mean, it was really just, you knew what you were getting ready to do. So, you know, you just get up every day and be ready to go. It was really just kind of like film boot camp. But we were just, you know, prepared and ready to go for each day, wherever we would have to go.
We had 65 locations in 19 days.
Good luck.
You know, so most days we were moving everything at least once, sometimes more than once. So we didn't have a huge footprint. We didn't have that many trucks or anything. But still, when you have to repark vehicles, you have to move your actors. Sometimes it's the next scene is a different day than the other, so there's a hair and makeup change. You know, it doesn't leave a whole lot of time for hanging around and, you know, hobbies and things.
No, yeah.
Your hobby is sleep. You know, that's the big thing you get to do at the end of the day.
I read the production notes for the film, and one of the things that you point out is that you had actually started with the actors you wanted to work with, Yolanda included, and I figure from there you went to the characters, and then you went to the place where you usually go, which is, or not usually, but you frequently go, which is to combine a popular genre with a political undercurrent. And how did you bring how did you bring those elements in? How did you know what story you wanted to tell?
Yeah, well, a lot of the story is it just works on a personal level. I mean, for instance, there's no reason that Bernice and Fontaine are African-American, except those were the two actresses I wanted to work with. But then just figuring what world did they come from, I wanted them to have gone to Compton High School at a certain time. I said, okay, well, then a lot of the people they know and from their worlds are also going to be African-American. You know, Eddie Olmos, once I decided to have him, is, okay, all of a sudden this is a Chicano LAPD detective, former guy, and so some of the world that he understands is going to be Latino. So some of it came out of the casting and who am I dealing with here and what makes sense. And then some of it came out of, if I'm going to send these people on a journey, there is the kind of personal journey that happens between these two women, especially, who used to be really tight friends, so tight they could go for sisters, who have lost track of each other and drifted very far apart in 20 years. And then there's the literal journey that they take. And what's an interesting journey for them to take? Where can I take them where they will be totally lost? Totally, you know, easy to find for the people who are looking for them, but they won't know what's going on. And I just figured, well, it's easy. You just cross the border. If you don't speak Spanish, and even if you do, you're in a world. And then let's add one more level to it. What if there's a Chinatown there? You know, and use it metaphorically like Robert Towne did in his script. La Chinesca is what the neighborhood in Mexicali is known as. And there's always been, in our culture, this level of mystery to the Chinatowns of, well, we don't understand what they're saying, we don't know what they're doing, and they kind of take care of their own business. And so I was using it literally as well as metaphorically of they're going into unknown territory. And what happens when you go into unknown territory? All of a sudden, three people who may have very, very different lives kind of have to support each other.
Yolanda, you know, this is essentially, it's in some ways an ensemble piece. It's you and your two co-stars here. And one of the pluses of the film is the chemistry that the three of you have together. Did you guys need to work on that to get what happened on camera going?
I wouldn't say there was a lot of work there. There wasn't work there. There was no time. Yeah, I mean, we had an opening night, like at our production house, like party where everybody, you know, cast and crew got to meet, and you know, we introduced ourselves to each other because, you know, I'd never met Lisa Gay or Eddie, and you know, I think everybody just clicked. You know, we just clicked, and from there the ride was on, because once we started, you know these are your people. Just like John said, it's like in the same way that those characters, you know, had to cling to each other, we did too as the actors, like leading the movie, because, you know, we're running the show in a way, you know. So, you know, there was no time to not like somebody, you know. We were just doing our thing and we all got along. I felt really well.
One of the things that I look for in actors is their ability to listen and their generosity as actors. And what I mean by generosity, you know, there are some actors who do very well for themselves, who really just take care of themselves. And, you know, they really, their attention starts to wander when they know the camera's behind them or over their shoulder. And it happens, you know, and they just, for whatever reason, once they're out of the beam of the camera, they kind of slack off. And so one of the things that I rely on when I hire actors is for them to help each other. So Yolanda and Lisa Gay had not a lot of time, but time in between scenes together to work on things together. And I prefer not to be there when I'm working with generous actors, you know, for them to really build up those things to help each other. Because what the last thing you want is their attention of, well, what does the director think? What does the director, you know, that can come when after I say cut or at the end of the day or whatever. But really, the question is, you know, what does Bernice think? What does Fontaine think? And that's who you have to hook into. And then there was this added thing is that there's this third guy in the car about a half hour into the movie, and I can't get eye contact out of this guy. So I don't know what he's thinking. You know.
Literally can't get eye contact.
You know, that's the thing, Yolanda, is knowing that a role was written for you is a great compliment. I could also see possibly that it puts a little pressure on you. You could go down the path of, well, what does he see in me? What does he want from me? Am I giving him enough of what he saw? Was there any problem with that?
No, there was no problem or any thought of that because, I mean, we met once in an audition and then, you know, years later he wrote this. So, you know, whatever he would be expecting or wanting from me, he would direct me, you know, in the scene. I can only give what I feel is Fontaine and then take his notes and guide it whichever way he wants it. And there was no thought of that.
Yeah, also, I think, you know, one of the reasons I'd cast Yolanda, we have a mutual friend who was always kind of talking her up. And, and you know, when I say, I should check who this out, and I looked her up, and I realized, well, I saw her in that, and 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 I realized, and I didn't realize it was the same person. Hmm. So a lot of what I cast Yolanda for is not that I'd seen her do something that I wanted her to do again, but just that she had pressed me so much in this audition, and then when I put together the things that I'd seen her in, I said, boy, well, this is somebody who can handle whatever I throw at her, you know, and it would be great to see what she would do with this part.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Do not argue with that. You know, the thing about Fontaine is that she does start off as sort of this dissipated, tenuous person, and she grows as the film progresses. How did you track sort of the place where Fontaine started and where she wound up?
I can't say it was necessarily tracking. It was more or less playing the moments, you know, and I guess a little bit in keeping track where we were in the story, but it is playing off of, you know, my friendship with Bernice and just the amount of time that we've spent together, you know, in this trip and how we have kind of gone back to our, you know, our childhood friendship, but at the same time, we've gone back to it as women, mm-hmm. you know. So, you know, there's a different thing there. There's a different dynamic. And so it's even bigger than it was before. So, I mean, you know, I think it may look like Fontaine's development, but it's more or less something that was in there just coming out more, I feel.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if the thing is well written enough and the actors are good, because you don't shoot in sequence, I mean, we were able to shoot the first scene between them first, and that after that, everything was way out of sequence in the shooting. You really are asking the actors to play the moment, and what's the moment? So one of the things that you see with Fontaine is her body language changes depending on the environment she's in. So at first she's in the parole office. She's, you know, she may have to go back to jail if this interview with this, you know, new parole officer doesn't work out. You know, so there's a certain body language. Then the next time we were see her, she's, you know, she's at her job and she's got this job to do. She's, you know, scraping the grill and, you know, putting the eggs in front of people and everything like that. We see her in her tiny phone booth sized apartment, and, you know, there's just, and then eventually what happens is she's in situations where she's been in the, you know, there's a line that Eddie Olmos's character has of, have you ever bought drugs on the street? And he's asking Bernice this. Well, Yolanda's character is the one who has. She's comfortable doing that. And now she's doing it kind of pretend, but it's something that she's done in much more desperate circumstances than this. So she's not afraid. Whereas Bernice, that's not her world. And that's why she eventually, you know, came to Fontaine. So there's an interesting way in which the two actresses, as you watch them in each situation, their body language changes because they're either more or less comfortable with it. And there is an arc to the situations that they're in. So, you know, it's almost like you don't usually want your actors to have to think about their arc. You know, you want them to think about the moment. And then when you put the moments in order, you know, there's something there.
You know, you do say that these are the actors you want to work with, but the fact is that you are well known for directing films with largely African American cast, largely Latino cast.
Now and then. I mean, Eight Men Out, which is 25 years old. Maybe there's one black guy who has a line, and that's it. That was the world of Major League Baseball then. You know, so it, you know, in my first movie, you know, Return of the Skull Caucus 7, you know, a bunch of my movies have, you know, nobody of color in them. But it's the world I live in, you know, and one of the reasons I started making movies is there was all this stuff in the world that I lived in that I didn't see on the screen. But I thought, well, that's a great story that's not being told. And, you know, here's some great actors who aren't being used enough or whatever, you know. And you know, to a certain extent, I have benefited from the fact that it's hard enough for any actor to get a job. But for Hispanic and African-American actors to get, you know, steady work is, you know, they're willing to come and work for scale for me because there's just not that much interesting stuff for them to do. You know, just in volume, you know, and it's not why I do it, but it is this interesting thing is I call these people up. I mean, we called James Earl Jones up. We didn't know him from Adam to be in Make One. And all of a sudden we get this phone call and there's Darth Vader's voice on the other end of it, you know, saying, you know, look, let's go do this thing.
John, are you black? You sound like us. That's what we say all the time. We don't see our stories on the screen.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I did read that because of your experience on the set and what you've acquired, you've moved into directing. You did your own film, Breaking Night. Did you do that before Go for Sisters or following?
I was actually doing scout location when I got the script for Go for Sisters. So it, you know, we shot it. While I was doing post, but you know, I was learning lines and stuff while shooting my own short, you know, because mine was only like 4 days, but it all happened around the same time, and it was really nice.
And you had about the same kind of lack of budget and time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was guerrilla filmmaking in both cases.
And it's exciting because, I mean, and I had mentioned to John, because, you know, he watched my cut, you know, before we had finished everything. It was like having, you know, us stay in a production house together and work together. It was like a bigger version of shooting my short. And I really loved the whole process of it.
Going in front of the camera after having been behind it, did that affect the way you approached your work on this film?
No, because I think in my head, I always think of both sides. I really do, because I want to make it as easy as possible on whoever my director is. But at the same time, I am very present in, as the character also. And, you know, and in Breaking Night, I was on both sides of that camera too. So, I mean, I love acting, but I do like being behind the camera and being part of the process of making the story.
Yeah, I think an interesting thing in this is one of the reasons that I also thought of Edward James Olmos for this is, although he's a, you know, really kind of iconic actor and we know him from all these big movies, he's made, you know, so many independent movies, both as a director and as an actor. He's worked with Robert Young a lot. I think they've made like a half dozen movies together. So he really understands what it is. You know, so I've got a guy who's, you know, basically a movie star, but he understands the limbo bar that you have to, you know, get yourself under if you've only got 19 days to shoot. You know, he's shot in equally desperate circumstances. And so it was great to have a guy with that much experience who just got it. You know, he got it, okay, you know, so maybe we don't even have a place to sit down, you know, in this particular location, and then at lunch we'll get to sit down, you know. But now, you know, and then the positive things about it, which is you don't spend a lot of time in the trailer. You don't go back to your hotel for days. Did you have a day off?
No,
Lisa Gay and Yolanda worked every single day, and then Eddie joined us 1 week into a 4 week shoot, and he worked, I think he had one day off in that whole time. And then when you get to the set, it's almost the same thing. You're either acting or you're getting your clothes changed to act at the next one, or you're being transported to the next one, and that's when you kind of go over your lines and all that kind of stuff. So there's a great immersion to it, that you don't have to find artificial ways to stay in character. You're not out of character long enough for it to wear off. And I think especially when there's this kind of this running relationship between the three characters, once that is established, it's just like, okay, where are we in that process? Is this an earlier scene or a later scene or whatever? But that familiarity with the other actors, you know, stay. I think it happens with people on TV shows.
Yeah,
you know,
and
who
they
come
become
week
like a
after
family.
Week after week, yeah. And they really do kind of understand how to help each other out and the rhythm of their characters together.
But do you say to yourself, next one I'm getting that Will Smith mobile home thing? Or?
I would like to have one of those truck things, period. I'm just living that.
Yeah, exactly. Permanently, yeah.
Yeah, it's better than New York City apartments. I mean, each project is different. There's certain things as an actor you would like. Like, I'd like to be driven to set. Like, I'd like to be driven anywhere because I just hate driving. Just, just certain things. But if it's something you want to do, I don't think you think about it that much because it's not the number one thing. You know, the project is. So.
Yeah. And, quite honestly, as I talk to actors, one thing a lot of actors say is, oh, you're really going to direct? You know, and there's a lot of actors who do projects where it's mostly let's do it again is the height of direction. So they're kind of on their own. And, you know, and not that actors need to be told exactly what to do, but they would like a little guidance every once in a while. And on some of these huge productions, they just don't get it. You know, they just kind of, okay, well, learn your line, stand here. You know, okay, we're done or we're not done or whatever, a little louder, you know, might even be welcome. And then they don't know at the end of it how they did, you know, and because there was no feedback. So I think, you know, actors want to act. And you see, you know, actors who could make gazillions of dollars come down and they'll do an independent project every once in a while. And I think that's a great thing for them to do for two reasons. One is they kind of realize how everybody else is doing it, you know, and they get a little perspective when they go back to their kind of movie star world. But also they get to play something that probably they wouldn't get paid the $10 million to play that. They get to play a part of their repertory, or, you know, I think of Nick Cage when he was in Leaving Las Vegas, you know, and I'm sure, you know, that was a very low budget movie. I think they shot it in 16 millimeter and stuff like that in a short period of time, but it was a great opportunity for him to do some stuff that he wasn't being asked to do in the superstar world.
So if John calls you and says you're ready for a road trip, are you?
I'm ready. I got my bag. I'm ready. Yeah. I'm ready. Because you know it's going to be well written. And that, to me, is where it starts.
John, Yolanda, thank you very much for talking.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you.
Gopher Sisters opened in New York on November 8th. It'll be opening in Los Angeles on the 15th and will be rolling out to other cities and possibly some border towns. Not so sure about that, but it will be rolling out all through November, December, and January. So look for it. We've got the trailer and the link to the official website over at mightymoviepodcast.com. And remember, we'll have a link there as well for the Inside the Fantastique Kickstarter. Please help us out, even if it's just a buck or two. Every buck helps. No fooling. You can also go directly to Kickstarter.com and do a search for CineFantastic. That'll get you there as well. And thank you. We're going to be doing a few more shows this month. Next up probably is Temple of Bad. Subject this time around, Blackenstein. You're not going to believe this one. You want to write me? Please send that email to Dan@mightymoviepodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This has been a production of Upstart Company NYC. Copyright 2013, Dan Persons. All rights reserved. No unauthorized duplication permitted.